Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, as the 14-year Syrian conflict draws to a close, we'll examine the extensive economic devastation left behind and explore the timeline and efforts required to rebuild the economy.
As tension grows, Syrians continue to flee their homes. 7 million people have now been displaced in what the UN says is the worst humanitarian crisis in more than two decades.
We'll be in Kenya for their latest round of economic talks and the latest on the Murdoch family power battle.
Mr. Murdoch, are you confident of victory?
Are there any ongoing settlement talks?
Any comment at all on the proceedings?
A court ruling has blocked the media mogul's plan to hand his empire to just one of his sons. Talk to us as we talk to you. You can get in touch with us on WhatsApp. The number is +44 330 678 3033, or send us an email, world.business@bbc.co.uk. But first today, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the group that led the overthrow of the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad, has announced plans to form a new government, pledging to restore order and stability. With the latest now, we can cross to Damascus and talk to BBC correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher. What's life like there at the moment, Barbara? Is there any semblance of a functioning society?
Very much more today than there have been in the past 2 days, where I think previously the capital was just kind of holding its breath while the rebels and their supporters celebrated. Today we had quite a lot of traffic on the streets. I saw a number of cafes and shops were open. Some government agencies had called for their workers to return, and anecdotally we were told that maybe about 40% did so. So I think there is more of a sense of normality now while people wait to see what happens. And you were talking about that move to install an interim prime minister. He is somebody who has been running most of Idlib province in the northwest for quite a long time. He belongs to a governing group that is linked to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. So he has a lot of experience in governing, and the leader of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham had mentioned again and again that he wanted an orderly transition of power in which public services would keep running. So that is why he's chosen somebody with that capability. I should add, banks have opened again today, which is another sign that people are beginning to resume their lives.
And people still feeling upbeat at the same time as perhaps going to work.
Well, yes. I mean, the reaction to the fall of the regime and the rebels coming into town, of course, is mixed, because there are different constituencies in Syria as well as in Damascus, but certainly many, many people have been responding with celebration. We were in the central square where, when I came into Damascus, it was full of fighters, you know, shooting in the air in a celebratory way. So quite a kind of aggressive celebration. Now you have, it's much more down to normal there now, but you still have people coming to, there's a tank in the square, and they come and they clamber all over it. They're chanting, they're singing. It's not just young guys, although, of course, there's many of them. There's women there too, some of them with children. You see a lot of rebel flags. So there is a sense of celebration. There is also, though, uncertainty, because there are constituencies that either supported the regime or are a bit worried, even if they didn't, what an Islamist-led government is going to be like. So you have it's not one response across all of the Syrian constituencies.
Barbara Plett-Usher, live there from Damascus, thank you very much for joining us. Well, the end of the 14-year conflict marks the close of a devastating war that claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, triggered one of the largest refugee crises in modern history, left cities in ruins, and severely weakened the economy due to global sanctions. Syria's economy contracted by 85% since 2011. That's according to the World Bank. Well, joining us now is Bent Nishella. She is head of the Middle East and North Africa Development Department at Germany's Heinrich Boller Institute. They're estimating that it could take 10 years for Syria to return to its 2011 GDP levels and 20 years to rebuild it completely. Syria presumably can't afford this reconstruction on its own. So who is going to provide the necessary funds?
Well, so far, the main donor, the leading donor, has been the European Union. Of all the years of crisis response that already were there for Syria, this has been the case. But I think the needs will always be bigger than what can be done. You already mentioned it, how much the Syrian economy shrank over the past years. And I think there are estimates from already the first 4 years of the war that there were losses of $226 billion. So you can imagine the task that is ahead.
Are you concerned about the level of support that the US might be able to provide? On Sunday night, the current president, Joe Biden, warned that Syria faces a period of risk and uncertainty, pledged that the United States would help where it can, while the president-elect Donald Trump stated on social media that it's not our fight, let it play out, and they're not to get involved.
This is a position we already saw during the first Trump presidency. And I think it is really risky, especially in terms of the US engagement in Syria's northeast and the Kurdish areas. It is crucial to protect the Kurds there and to make sure that they, as a relevant Syrian group, get integrated in the new power balance that is established.
What about the lifting of sanctions? They've had a significant impact on exports, especially oil. What are the prospects of lifting those sanctions?
Given that most of these sanctions are in place against the Assad regime, which now is gone, I think it needs a process of revisiting the sanctions and seeing which ones still make sense. That would be the smart sanctions that target people who were involved in human rights violations. But the oil exports, for example, or the banking sector, I think it is time to revisit them. But at the same time, we also don't know how will the next government of Syria look like.
Because HTS is on the terrorism list, isn't it? So lifting those sanctions is not going to be straightforward.
Exactly. So I think there needs to be found a way to deal with that. The reason why HTS is on the list is the fear that they might carry out terrorist attacks. However, we hear HTS has abandoned the jihadist ideology long ago. They now consider themselves an Islamist but nationalist organization, and therefore it might be time to take them off the terrorism list. I think it should be studied carefully.
Do you think that the European Union might be more willing to give aid to Syria because of the migrant crisis that the war in Syria has created?
I do think so, because it is really a relevant domestic question that is being discussed in many of the European countries, but also in Turkey. The pressure in Turkey or other neighboring states is high for the return of refugees. As we've seen, more than 5 million people fled from Syria to the neighboring countries and the European Union. So the question of the possibility for them to return, which many Syrians would like to do, depends also on the prospects of having a perspective inside Syria. And this is related to reconstruction.
I want to bring Fiona Sincotta into our conversation now. Fiona is an investment expert. She's a senior market analyst at City Index. Fiona, I understand that stocks in construction companies in Turkey have gone up on news that they might get some business, presumably, out of the rebuilding of Syria.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, you know, when we've been sort of thinking about here about the extent of damage that has been caused that has happened in Syria, and a large amount of that is sort of been attributed to physical infrastructure damage. And as a result, as you said, we've seen a positive reaction from particularly cement and steel makers in Turkey, who have surged on that expectation that they could be heavily involved in the rebuilding of neighbouring Syria.
Bente, does that sort of give some comfort in that commercial companies are looking at this as an investment opportunity, or a place where they can also, you know, make some money and help with the reconstruction?
It does. And I think already the readiness means a lot to Syrians, because it inspires trust. If there are companies going in, people would not invest if they didn't think there might be more stability. And this is what Syrians are looking for.
Bente Schiller from the Heinrich Böller Institute in Berlin. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme. Fiona Sincotta will stay with us. We'll come and talk to you in a moment. Let's turn now, though, to Kenya, where high-level discussions on the nation's economic challenges and reforms are underway. These meetings, led by the International Monetary Fund, are focusing on strategies to manage Kenya's ballooning public debt, boost domestic revenues, and ensure sustainable economic growth. However, many Kenyans have criticised the IMF for its handling of the country's economic challenges. In the summer, when there were deadly anti-tax riots in Kenya, there was a lot of animosity directed towards the IMF. So how is the organisation going to ensure that that doesn't happen again? I asked their Deputy Managing Director, Nigel Clark.
I have been in Kenya for the past few days to listen, to learn, to engage with a variety of stakeholders in the private sector, stakeholders in civil society, among the parliamentarian group, and in the government, inclusive of President Ruto. I've had very fruitful and productive discussions, which have served to deepen understanding of the opportunities and challenges that Kenya faces, as well as to frame the potential menu of policy options that Kenya, is considering.
Do you understand what people in Kenya, how they feel, what they think of the IMF? Because I think some of them think that your financial support comes with very tough conditions that are really hurting people.
Well, you see, Sam, the challenges that face Kenya today, Kenya is at a very important crossroads in its economic development, having to balance the pressing needs of social expenditure to meet the needs of citizens, while at the same time meeting its interest bill. And in order to do both, enhancing its capacity to raise revenue, but doing all of those within a socially cohesive way. And those are very difficult challenges that Kenya is facing with a great degree of courage.
So what are you actually putting conditions on in order for Kenya to get more IMF funding?
Our engagement with Kenya comes about because of Kenya's balance of payments needs. In terms of the implementation of policy, we provide advice, and our advice consists of a menu of potential policy options. Ultimately, it's the government of Kenya, the authorities in Kenya, to choose and make the decisions on the specific menu of policies that they will implement to address the challenges. And in the implementation and in the choice of those policies, it's always important not only to consider the economic realities, but to take into consideration the social and political environment, and to take into consideration what is socially and politically possible while also maintaining the cohesion of the society.
The World Bank is predicting that the economy is heading for its worst performance since the coronavirus-induced contraction in 2020. What's gone wrong this year in particular?
Well, let's put that in context. I believe that we are talking here about 4.5% growth, which indeed is lower than the previous year and indeed is lower than what was originally projected. But 4.5% is far above the world average, and indeed in most of the world would be considered a quite healthy rate of growth. The challenge, Sam, is that growth in the context of the structure and size of Kenya's debt, in the context of the revenues that are available to the Kenyan state, that growth is not enough for the dynamics I've just described.
So what's going to happen? What has to happen?
You know, the Kenyan authorities, the Kenyan society is meeting these challenges with enormous courage and optimism. The IMF stands by to support Kenya through this period, and there are what we have to do, or what the Kenyan authorities have to do in conjunction with stakeholders in their society, is arrive at the blend of policy options and policy choices that together can meet the challenges that confront Kenya, but to do so with broad consultation to ensure that whatever policy choices are adopted have the support of the people. This is not a challenge that can be met by the government alone. It's a challenge that is going to require the cohesion of the Kenyan society, of all elements of Kenya coming together to, first of all, acknowledge the depth of the challenge that is faced, and together to arrive at solutions that can meet those challenges while ensuring that, you know, there is public trust, and that public trust is going to be important to underpin any menu of options that are ultimately taken on by the Kenyan people.
Because what you don't want to see are the same images that we saw in the summer, where there was graffiti emblazoned on walls saying, "MIMF, keep your hands off Kenya."
Sam, no one wants to see a repeat of what happened over the summer. That was tragic. And the tragic loss of life is saddening to all who witnessed it. No one wants a repeat of that.
That was IMF Deputy Managing Director Nigel Clark. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick. We're going to talk about food prices now, because the price of coffee on international commodity markets has hit its highest level on record. The price of Arabica beans, they're the ones that most of us drink, have increased by 80% this year. Fiona Sincotta, Senior Market Analyst at City Index, can tell us what's happening and why have they gone up so high.
Oh, I know. Not what we want to hear. No.
Not right before Christmas.
No. So basically, the two largest producers here, so we're talking about Brazil and Vietnam, have been hit by bad weather. And that means that the crops have been hit, reducing supply. And this comes at a time when the popularity of coffee continues to grow. So we're seeing demand continuing to grow while supply is reduced. Now, up to now, the companies have actually been absorbing a lot of the increases in prices that we're seeing. But actually, as expected, as we head into the new year, that we might in fact see those price increases appearing on the shelves in the supermarkets.
So what sort of increases might we be able to sort of anticipate?
Oh, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, you know, if we talk about where coffee is trading, it's trading at all-time highs. I mean, we can probably expect to see some of the companies continuing to absorb some of those costs, but I do think that they will be needing to pass on. I mean, I don't want to be putting prices on the shelves at the moment, but I mean, for example, at the moment it's trading at £3.44 a pound on the international exchange, and as you said, that's up around 80% year to date.
They often say, don't they, these consumer companies, that they are, you know, taking the costs so the consumer doesn't have to, but do they really? I mean,
yeah,
you know, inflation has been at 10% over the last couple of years.
Yes, it has. And, you know, I think it has been a mixed case, because obviously they can't pass on. There is a very fine line between what they can pass on and before consumers will stop purchasing. So they want to make sure that they actually keep demand. They don't cross that line where they put prices up by too much so that it just causes consumers to go to look for an alternative product or to just stop buying that product completely. So yes, I do think there is some absorption of the costs that we do see.
Now, Fiona, I've got a question for you. Have you ever found yourself angry or outraged at a post on social media?
Yes.
All the
time.
Too many times. Yeah. It might be an article or a thread with a provocative opinion. Well, if you have, like Fiona, then you have been the victim of rage bait. It's content that's specifically designed to make you angry. And it's big business, as Megan Lawton has been finding out.
How pretty can you actually get? Can you actually, like, literally get any prettier?
Welcome to the online world of Winter Zesu.
Every single video of mine that has gained, like, millions and millions of views is because of, unfortunately, because of hate comments.
The 24-year-old social media influencer says she made $150,000 last year exploiting a new online trend. Rage baiting.
Literally, just if people get mad or if people see something going on in the video, the video is going to go viral and like it's engagement. I can make money on TikTok. Instagram is paying, like YouTube pays you, Snapchat. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to post everything on every platform. So
she's part of a growing group of online creators making rage bait content where the goal is simple. Record videos, produce memes, and write posts that make other users viscerally angry, then bask in the thousands or even millions of shares and likes.
I just have that spark in me. I'm just super cute.
The more content they create, the more engagement they get, the more that they get paid.
Andrea Jones is a marketing strategist based in Toronto in Canada.
Even if those views are negative or inciting rage and anger in people.
You know what's so funny? Like, you could be wearing the cutest outfit and if it's ribbed, it immediately looks cheap. There, I said it.
Experts say its popularity online is due to the way social media algorithms work, a set of rules that analyze user preferences to show content that's most relevant.
If we see a cute cat or something or a cute dog, we're like, oh, that's cute. But if we see someone making something that we're like, this is obscene, we may type in the comments like, this is terrible. And that sort of comment actually is seen as a higher quality engagement by the algorithm.
The rise of rage bait has coincided too with new creator programs.
So a lot of these platforms, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, they oftentimes have creator programs and they incentivize people who create content on their apps to create more content.
But for Arielle Hazel, an assistant professor of communications and media at the University of Michigan, the negatives are clear.
One of the things that we see happen is that people are sort of overwhelmed by negativity in these environments. The concern is that long term, we won't be able to get anybody's attention and get them to pay attention to the things that we hope that they should be paying attention to.
We contacted the major social media platforms to see what they had to say about rage bait on their sites. At the time of recording, we had no responses. But we do know it's on their radar. In October, a Meta executive took to Threads to report an increase in engagement bait on their platform, adding, "We're working to get it under control." But if rage bait continues to pay, it's likely to continue to appear on our social feeds.
That was Megan Lawton reporting for us. And if you'd like to hear more on that, search for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Her full report is there. Now it's the season of goodwill, allegedly. So what better time to make amends with your family? Could that be what's happening right now in the Murdoch household? Rupert Murdoch has lost his legal battle over his media empire. A Nevada court commissioner has denied his bid to alter the family trust, which would have ensured his eldest son, Lachlan, took control of News Corp and Fox News after his death. The decision means that control of the company will remain equally divided among his four eldest children, Lachlan, James, Elizabeth and Prudence. Well, let's talk to Claire Atkinson now. She's an expert on the Murdoch family media empire and also set to release a biography on Rupert Murdoch next year. What a family saga this is turning into. This was a court case held very privately, wasn't it, in a court in Nevada. Was it the decision that you anticipated? Are you surprised by this court's decision?
I think it was very hard to tell which way the commissioner, it's a probate case which involves family law and trusts, and this was a specific court where they deal with that, and the commissioner said he did not agree with the proposal to change the irrevocable trust. But, you know, you use the word battle. I think it's a war, and this is, the first stop. And so Rupert's lawyer has said they will appeal the decision. And you can imagine perhaps it goes all the way through state courts in Nevada until Rupert gets the decision he wants. It is a very, on the face of it, a very important decision because it, solidifies the three kids have been on one team. We've had Lachlan and Rupert on the other. And, it was a very intriguing statement that Prudence, Elizabeth and James put out yesterday.
Yeah, I was going to say they want to that they want to move beyond litigation to focus on strengthening, rebuilding relationships among all family members.
Right.
Good luck with that.
Yes, good luck with that if appeals are going on. But Rupert got married this year. Lachlan was the only child who went to the wedding. James left the company a couple of years ago and has had a pretty rocky relationship with his dad and his brother since then. It's almost a Prince William, Prince Harry kind of a story. And so, you know, this decision really kind of is a win for James in the short term. And it will be interesting to see, you know, what happens over the holidays. Rupert has been in Australia lately. He's been at Lachlan's annual holiday party. And so he's out and about. And, you know, we'll see what happens next.
I mean, what do investors think? Let's bring Fiona in. What's the share price doing at the moment with all of this family saga going on in the background?
Yeah, well, interestingly, I mean, the two companies that are in focus here is Fox News and then News Corp. And to be fair, they're holding up pretty well. Across the year, we've got News Corp is up 19% year to date, so slightly underperforming the S&P 500, but still within its peers, it's sitting pretty well. And Fox is up 55% year to date, again, well within its group of peers. So we've just seen a slight sell-off in News Corp, down 1% over the past 5 days.
Claire Atkinson, you're writing a book about the Murdoch family. You've got plenty to write about in the coming few months, haven't you?
It never ends. I mean, there really is never an end to the story. There's another headline every time I turn around. I think it will be an impossible book to end, or there'll be just endless other updates.
Thank you so much for joining us on the programme. That's Claire Atkinson, expert on the Murdoch family empire, releasing a book next year on Rupert Murdoch. Thanks also to Fiona Sincotta, as ever, for joining us on World Business Report. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us then if you can.